Hello, and welcome to As My Whimsy Takes Me. I'm Caris Ellison.
And I'm Sharon Hsu. And today we are headed back to Pimm's Publicity once again with our third episode on Murder Must Advertise. And last time we'd mentioned how handy it is when the book gives us a nice little sum up chapter, you know, Peter tells somebody about the investigation so far, or a little inquest, or a set of notes, something to just, you know, the facts were these kind of feel. And Caris was pointing out to me as we were getting ready to record that we ourselves could probably use one of those, or our listeners could use one of those, as we have not actually talked about the mystery all that much. As I've maundered on about modernism and we got sidetracked.
I think this is just, we're just not very good about talking about the mystery because we are so interested in everything that's not the mystery.
Did you notice this particular line? I love this metaphor. Here's Peter being clever.
Dead body? What dead body?
What dead body? But yeah, Caris, do you want to do... I'm like... Not it. it's also, I mean, this is also a slightly difficult mystery to talk about because for so much of the book, you know, we as the audience and Peter, we're just like trying to find out what the mystery is.
Right.
But I think, you know, as we're kind of approaching this partway point, yeah, it might be good to just go over what we know so far and what Peter knows so far. So, Caris, would you take it away?
Sure. So, like we mentioned before, really kind of briefly, that what Peter started to investigate is the hint that there is something not quite right going on at Pimm's Publicity. Victor Dean died suddenly by falling down a staircase and left behind an unfinished letter. And that's all that Pimm of Pimm's Publicity knows. Whereas Peter... He comes onto the scene, he kind of like looks at the facts of Victor Dean's death and is just like, I think that this was a murder. You know, despite all of the like professional medical evidence, which we know from the inquest summary that it was ruled an accidental death, that he just fell on the staircase and either like died from hitting his head on like the railing or died from breaking his neck in the fall. But Peter finds it very suspicious. And so he's convinced pretty much out of the gate that there's been a murder. And so he sets to looking for reason, because like you don't premeditate a murder without a motive, essentially, I hope. Essentially, he's looking for what Victor Dean knew and information about who Victor Dean had issues with, what was going on, and really kind of stumbles into the fact that Victor Dean was like a not well-loved, tended to steal people's ideas, tended to find out things and hold them over people. I don't know that Peter has confirmation at this point that he was a blackmailer, but he definitely has the impression. And I think that's something that he's looking for early on, because he forms the opinion that the half-written letter was written as a threat, right? And that's like, mm-hmm. It was left incomplete on purpose, but it was just that it was written to be shown to someone as a threat. So he's looking for blackmail.
I feel like from reading kind of other mysteries of this period, and certainly of earlier mysteries like Sherlock Holmes and stuff, mm-hmm. blackmail was considered to be a very low kind of crime, right? Like, is it Holmes at one point who's basically like, you know, I consider a blackmailer beneath even a murderer or something. Like, blackmail was just not a very gentlemanly thing to do then or now, I suppose.
It's a low class kind of crime, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I have a vague sense of that from just like other Golden Age and earlier mysteries I've read.
Yeah. I think it might have been Poirot. Because that does sound
like a
familiar.
Poirot-y thing to think. Yeah. I enjoy that I just stated that with no research to back it up. Should we do some real-time? Okay. I did find this one quote. Basically, Holmes is talking about Charles Augustus Milverton, mm-hmm. who he terms the king of all blackmailers. And he says, do you feel a creeping, shrinking sensation, Watson, when you stand before the serpents in the zoo and see the slithery, gliding, venomous creatures with their deadly eyes and wicked, flattened faces? Well, that's how Milverton impresses me. I've had to do with 50 murderers in my career, but the worst of them never gave me the repulsion which I have for this fellow. So it's not quite saying blackmail is worse than murder, but I think that idea of it being like really underhanded and like grotesque in a way.
Yeah.
That a good clean murder just, you know, isn't.
I do feel like that's something that gets repeated. I think it's notable that one of the things that came up when we were trying to find the source of that was a quote from Sayers about, you know, Sir M.P. Biggs talking about refusing to represent a blackmailer because they're the worst.
Mm-hmm. From one of the short stories.
Yeah. And now of course I've lost. Oh, here we go. From The Unprincipled Affair of the Practical Joker. Sir M.P. Biggs calls it a crime crueler and infinitely worse in its results than murder. So I think, you know, knowing that Sayers was a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes, I think there's a definite echo there. And I do feel like it's something that, like a sentiment that I've seen in, you know, other things. Like I perhaps one of our listeners will be able to put their finger on it, but I really... like, I feel in my heart that Poirot also says something about blackmailers, and I can't place it, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does strike me as something a sentiment Poirot would feel.
Right? Yeah.
Because he is also very gentlemanly and concerned with manners and so forth, so...
But, yeah, so we already have a negative impression of Victor Dean, but it somehow manages to go lower.
And sorry, this is I'm already taking us off text, which is
outline great. What outline
recording outline what outline title of our memoir, but it does strike me just now when we were talking about it, because I was like, oh, the irony of Poirot being like, you know, blackmailers are so underhanded when he calls everybody into a room and is like, here's your secret and here's your secret and here's your secret, but. You know, I think there is a way in which the blackmailer, even more than the murderer, is sort of the flip side of the detective, right? Because the detective finds out all and then reveals all in the service of justice,
right,
and truth, whereas the blackmailer finds out all, threatens to reveal all, but it's all done for personal gain. It's done to, you know, either... torture somebody psychologically or for the blackmailer's material gain.
I'll just throw in there, like, I know exactly what you mean, that the idea of like Poirot gathering, but that's, I realized recently when I was rereading a bunch of Poirot, is that impression mostly comes from the classic show, which makes sense, you know, like in a visual, you know, like collecting all the actors, and it's not exactly in the text that Poirot does that. There are a lot of places where Poirot does kind of like keep people's secrets for them, or for people that he considers to be innocent, that he like arranges or like does his best to arrange for things to be painless as possible. Mm-hmm. Like TV Poirot does collect everyone and tell them what happened, but I think for the most part book Poirot does that in situations like Murder on the Orient Express, where like everyone is in,
spoiler alert,
yeah, where, you know, but like where everyone is intimately involved in the solution. And I can't remember, like maybe Death on the Nile is the same, but like those are both kind of like closed room mysteries in a way, where everyone has a reason to know all the secrets. Whereas in some of the others, he keeps confidences. He even, like, he encourages people to confess to him by promising to keep their secrets. So I forget why I got led into that, but that was something that I noticed when I was reading them. Just like,
I led you into that.
Like, I was just like, oh, like we all have this impression of Poirot being like, everyone come in, it's time for the big reveal.
For me to tell everybody about the worst thing that ever happened to you.
But that's mostly something that happens for the benefit of tidying things up in a visual medium, as opposed to text. What were we talking about before that, though? You were talking about the detective reveals all in the interests of justice, and that makes him the reverse. Okay, yes, now I've remembered where we are. But I think that's a really good observation, though. Like, I got sidetracked being like, I just want to correct some facts about Poirot, and I completely interrupted that good observation.
Well, it's like, yeah, why is there this, like, seemingly universal trope that blackmailers are the worst of the worst, right? Is it just everybody tipping their hat to Sherlock Holmes, or is there kind of a, you know, the natural enemy of the mongoose is kind of thing?
Yeah, no, you're right. Because, I mean, and even, I think, like, we'll talk about this more in our next episode when we kind of sum the book up, but there are obviously instances where the text will be like, this murder was kind of justified, you know, and where it's possible to be very sympathetic to the murderer, where the murderer is not the detective's enemy in that way, but like a blackmailer, you can't make an ethical argument for a blackmailer. There's just no, if you think of the detective as being the word that comes to mind is paladin, the paladin of truth, you know, like the you know, but isn't life, I do feel like that's a defining element of like the fictional detective, is that devotion to truth above everything. And yeah, the opposite of that is the blackmailer, someone who perverts truth for personal gain. Yeah, I think that that's really interesting and very accurate. And if someone would like to write us a paper about it.
In this essay, I will.
It worked one time.
Yes, it did. Oh, but okay. Before I was like, please tell us about this thing and let me immediately interrupt you with this brand new thought.
Let me interrupt you with this other thought.
But yes, so you were summing up that Peter has a sense that Dean knew something, and the text hints that Peter highly suspects he was blackmailing someone at the office, possibly. Or getting ready to blackmail Pym. Sort of like, I know something untoward is going on in your office, and I could reveal it unless... I mean, you'd think he'd have the good sense to not blackmail Mr. Pym, but...
I mean, he would if he thought that he could get away with it. I think the thing about Victor Dean is that he would do anything if he thinks he can get away with it. Yes, we receive a very unpleasant perspective of Victor Dean from pretty much everyone except his sister, who, you know, like, you don't always show your worst side to your siblings. Or maybe they assume the best of you if they don't, you know, that is kind of like a get where, like, Pamela Dean seems to have thought that Victor was, you know, just a good brother, like, that we get a little glimpse into her thoughts, like we talked about last time, where she thinks about how Victor would want her to, you know, find out the truth, where it's just like, actually, he was not the type of person that would want you to clear his name and solve all this stuff, because he wasn't that kind of person that cares about that. So, you know, in some ways, it's just like, how well did you know your brother, Pamela? Maybe not very well, but... all of that is like, we were going to sum up like the mystery, and I keep wandering into the weeds. But all right, so but this whole time that Peter has been working in the copy department, he's been trying to figure out, you know, like, who had a motive to get rid of Dean and who Dean might have had something over. And it's like, and he, you know, he's trying to do it without anyone realizing that he's investigating anything. So he mostly just does it by being just gossipy as hell, which seems to be the perfectly normal for the copy department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he doesn't need a little old lady.
No.
In this case, because he's like, oh, everybody here just loves to talk about each other.
And, you know, like, we have, or at least I have the impression that he's not gaining a lot of ground other than having his suspicions confirmed about like Victor Dean's death. You know, he finds out that the scarab, you know, like, was found in the hallway, and he goes up on the roof and he finds, like, there's pebbles up here, and you can see through the skylight, which would have been opened onto the staircase. And so and at this time of day, everyone is everywhere. And so he's just like, okay, like, and, you know, he finds out about the catapult, like all those little pieces come together. He's just like, okay, I know exactly how the murder was done. And he figures all of that out, like the mechanics of the murder, fairly early. And through taking, like, through the assistance of Ginger Joe, the messenger boy, he gets an idea of which people are unaccounted for. But as far as, like, the why and who, he's really left with not a lot to go on until the Great New Tracks row, which is when, like, just the presence of that 50 pounds in Tallboy's desk is, he's just like, does that have something to do with anything?
It's a bit suggestive.
It's suggestive. It's an irregularity, but it still doesn't tell him anything. And it doesn't, it certainly doesn't tell us, the reader, anything. And it's not until he starts doing his Harlequin act with Diane de Montmory that he, through a great deal of exhaustive effort. Another irregularity was that Victor Dean was involved with this crowd of bright young things who are adjacent to the dope trade because they all take drugs. So he's using Diane de Montmory to try and get a window onto that side of it to find another irregularity that he can, you know, like, find cracks to kind of weasel into. Considering that we come into the book with not a clear idea of what the mystery is, and then we seem to solve the murder fairly quickly, but then we're left being like, there's this larger mystery that it's so, like, it's so hard to get a handle on, and it's hard to discuss from the front end without, you know, like, starting at the back and giving away everything. And
yeah, we'll come back and pick up some of the threads once we do the reveal. We'll probably do the reveal, I don't know, maybe fairly early on in our last episode, just so we can go back and be like, and this, and this, and this.
Yeah, because this is one of those books where if you're reading it for the mystery, I think it might be very annoying because the mystery is so obfuscated by personality, which, like, for us, we're reading for personality. We're delighted. And I'm just like,
yeah, this is like a great book, qua book.
Yeah, just absolute catnip. But for someone who, like, is really interested in the mechanics of the mystery, I can imagine this being frustrating.
But I think would be so rewarding on reread.
That's true.
Like, I feel like it's almost the opposite of a Have His Carcass, where from the beginning, and you know, you've touched on this, the mystery of the mystery versus the mystery of the text, right? Where in a Five Red Herrings or a Have His Carcass, it's like everything is given to you pretty much that you need from the get-go. Like,
and it's just, can you parse it out? Is.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in this one, it's you... I think it would be extremely difficult on first reread to really figure out all the pieces and all the clues that become meaningful later on. And, you know, maybe that's why I enjoy it so much, because I'm more of a rereader than a reader of mystery, in that, like, if I can't figure it out, cool, but I'm not tying myself into knots about it. But if you are a, like, I must figure it out before the detective does, I could see this one being pretty frustrating.
Yeah, because it's just... It's like clouds of witness, you know, like, if there's too many clues,
Well, and you don't know what is significant, right? Going back to that whole, literary criticism makes us all paranoid readers, because it's like, what is actually significant here? But, you know, mysteries in particular, I think this is one that might create more paranoia than usual, because you're just like, I don't know, there's all this stuff about Peter in an office, and maybe it's all... Maybe there's something here, but also he's dressing up like a Harlequin and, like, running around with you know, a pretty dangerous gang at night. Is this the part that's significant? But then, you know, the strands begin to come together. And...
Yeah, it's a big fog of stuff. And I remember the first time reading it, which... It was one of the early Whimsies that I read, so I didn't have as strong an idea of the character. You know, like, it wasn't the very first one, but it was, I'm pretty sure that I had read it before I read, like, Strong Poison and Have His Carcass, and I don't even think that I had read Whose Body. So I remember reading it and just being like, how does all this come together? like, this is a little bit weird, but I wanted to, you know, kind of like circling back to Peter kind of like getting connected with the dope ring through Diane de Montmory. I think you quoted in maybe our first episode where Sayers said something about, you know, like she needed to write a book quickly. She was writing Nine Taylors slowly, but she needed to produce something for a contract. And so she decided to write about an office because it was familiar. But then also a dope ring, which she doesn't know anything about.
Yeah.
That's paraphrasing heavily. But we don't spend just a ton of time on the dope subplot necessarily. But we do spend a little bit of time with Diane de Montmory, and we spend just small snippets of time in her perspective. And I think she's interesting because she's very different from just about any other character I think that we get in Sayers. We get that she does what she does because she's bored with life. You know, you mentioned Anne Dorland when we were putting our notes together for a completely different reason, but I think that made a connection in, but Anne Dorland in Unpleasantness at the Bologna Club, who, you know, is someone who's in a position of privilege. She's the ward of this wealthy woman who's in line to inherit, you know, a lot of money. And she's has this like life of leisure, but doesn't know what to do with herself and doesn't know how to use her talents. Doesn't, you know, and a little bit like Lady Mary, right? Where she doesn't have an outlet for her energies, doesn't know how to find fulfillment. Like Anne Dorland was a person who was looking for an identity and looking for an outlet, trying to shape herself into different things. Like there's that wonderful line about, you know, leaving the books we read behind like lobster shells as we outgrow them. We see Anne Dorland do that. We see Lady Mary do it in Unnatural Death. We see like the poor girl that eventually gets murdered, whose name I'm blanking on.
Vera Finletter.
Yeah, we see that she was trying to do that, and like with very unfortunate results.
But you know who Diane de Montmory also reminds me of a bit is Mrs. Weldon.
Oh yeah,
in the sense of I like the way that Diane initially, you know, I guess like one of the ways she's trying to occupy her time or find an identity is trying to find like a man to thrill her, I think is really what it is. Like, you know, so she has the fling with Victor Dean and pretty quickly gets tired of him. And I think that's, you know, Peter's like, I had to advertise myself to get her attention, right? With like diving into the pool and you know, masking himself and being really mysterious, because she's kind of where I think Mrs. Weldon was looking to fall in love. You know, I think she was sillier than Diane in that she was looking to fall in love because she had this idea of romance and of also that she was still, you know, youthful and attractive and so forth, and that, you know, men weren't, the young dancers weren't falling in love with her because of her money. I think Diane's maybe, I think the text implies that she likes falling in love because, again, it gives her something to do. I think that aspect, so even though it's like driven by different motivations, it did remind me really strongly of Mrs. Weldon. But I think you're right in that Diane is given a lot more interiority and a lot more characterization beyond just being a predatory old hag as Harriet in the book thought about Mrs. Weldon.
You know, like it's just a tiny glimpse that we get, right, of Diane's interiority, kind of the same amount of small glimpse that we get into Willis and into Pamela Dean. And I don't know, like, I think she intrigues me because I think that she's not a nice person, right?
No.
No, like she picks people up and drops them and gets them dragged into drug using circles and doesn't care about people very much. All she cares about is not being bored. But it's also very sad. Like there's something very tragic about her, just about that need to find fulfillment somewhere and not having a way to get it and letting it ruin you and ruin everyone around you. And Peter is quite mean to her in some ways, which is not unwarranted, but also it's just like, I don't know, like I feel like the text judges Diane de Montmory very harshly, which I'm just like, you're not wrong, but also isn't it sad?
Yeah, I'm like looking at that exchange, chapter 9, which is even titled Unsentimental Masquerade of a Harlequin, right? So Peter is unsentimental in how he's using her. This is where he cuts in on this like car race that she's doing. He says, "What are you good for to me?" She says, "I'm beautiful." "Not so beautiful as you were in 5 years' time, you will be ugly." 5 years? I wouldn't want you for 5 years, she says. And then he says, "I wouldn't want you for 5 minutes." And then later on, he bestowed the kisses like deliberate insults. Like, I think, is it by the end of this? It's like a later scene between the two of them where she suddenly, you know, feels like there's something eerie about him, and her attraction to him turns to fear and dread. But like, yeah, pretty much from the get-go. I mean, Peter, this is my version of you calling Dorothy L. Sayers a white liberal. But I'm like, Peter is nagging her, which I don't love for anyone.
Yeah. On the other hand, I think that him being harsh with her is one of the things that keeps him intriguing to her. Like, I think it's a calculated way of holding her interest. You know, she's so used to everyone catering to her that it makes him interesting. But
that's nagging.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
The definition.
It is.
I'm sorry. I'll drop it. But
you're not wrong. But I also, like, this is a kind of quasi-seduction that he doesn't actually want to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely get the impression that he's, like, disgusted by her, that there's a certain amount of revulsion. And so it's a way to be interesting to her without
having to go through with the seduction. And we've seen him do that before.
Mm.
In Unnatural Death, we see him also sort of play act at a seduction. And in that case, he's sort of confirming that the other party is sort of revolted by him. It's, again, it's not like a seduction in earnest, or even one that he thinks he needs to go through with. But like, yeah, it is interesting to see him in that mode. And then to contrast it with like how he's trying to get Harriet to like him, yeah, in his other books. Like, oh, Peter, we've seen you like actually try to get someone to fall in love with you. And it's the opposite of this, yeah, like suave, weird, cold persona.
Yeah, I do think the negging Diane de Montmorency is an outlet for his genuine feelings of revulsion. But, you know, kind of like speaking of the difference between how Peter treats these other women that he's not seducing in earnest versus how he treats Harriet. This is kind of like going back to our outline, but backwards, because we put on our list that we wanted to talk about the conflict between Tallboy and Smail. And it brings up the public and private school differences. And I'm going to circle back to that, but I want to lead with the end of that kind of scene, because it has that little encounter with Miss Meatyard that ties into this.
I shall allow it.
And like, I apologize to our listeners, I'm doing everything ass backwards today. But so like, this whole conversation happens in Miss Meatyard's office, and like Peter says a throwaway line, if everybody had the same face, there'd be no pretty women. And Miss Meatyard makes a grimace, and she says, if you go on like that, I shall be getting an inferiority complex too. Breeden looked at her gravely. I don't think you'd care to be called pretty, he said, but if I were a painter, I should like to make a portrait of you. You have very interesting bones. Good God, said Miss Meatyard, I'm going. Let me know when you've finished with my room. There was a mirror in the typist room, and in this, Miss Meatyard curiously studied her face. And so, like, you know, like, we obviously get the idea that Peter, in his guise as Breeden, made an impression that she tried to laugh off, but, you know, like, it still hit home. And we were talking a little bit before we started about like the enduring appeal of Peter as a character, because you and I are not the only people who are just like, oh, Peter. I know that there are many other readers who feel the same. I believe probably a lot of our listeners feel the same, where it's just like, there is just something about Peter as a character who just like, it gets under your skin, gets into your heart, and has a really strong appeal. And I think that This little interaction with Miss Meatyard is an example of that, because it's his sincerity. What makes Peter appealing as an object of romance? Is that the way I want to say that? No, like the appeal of Peter as a love interest, and the dance we see him do with Harriet, is it a lot of it hinges on sincerity and honesty. And so like the Peter that seduces Diane de Montmory.
Unsentimental and insincere, yeah.
You know, like, it's nothing. There's no appeal to that. It actually makes, you know, like, you read those scenes and you're just like, oh, I feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I don't like it, which we're not supposed to like it. But you know, I'm just like, that's not the Peter that I know and love.
Yeah, yeah.
The things that Peter says to Harriet are always and forever sincere and honest. And that's part of what makes their romance so appealing and so enduring that we're still, like, all these decades later being like, this is one of the most romantic things that's ever happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny. I am so, you know, confession time. For a while, I was very fascinated by reality TV dating shows, especially kind of in the era where people who competed on them could, you know, become Instagram famous afterward and make a living off of influencing. And it was, you know, it was very clear that a lot of people weren't going on trying to find love. They were there to get famous and to have a following. And these shows also fascinated me from a narrative point of view, because I do think some of the production that goes in is masterful, where you're like, I can see the storyline they're putting together, and yet I am very, very invested, you know? Like, I can see that they're making these people characters, and yet, like, it's very strong storytelling. And I also liked listening to podcasts where other people would kind of pick apart, like, this is the narrative that's, you know, being invented.
Well, what an interesting microcosm of human behaviors, right? Like,
yes, yes, like, huge sociology experiment. And I think especially in the era where you had to go on and kind of, like, pretend that you were there to fall in love. Like, now it's a little less interesting to me, because I'm like, oh, it's too obvious that everybody's here to get famous. So
yeah,
the, like, doubled narrative is kind of gone. So I don't really care anymore. Mm. But there was this one podcast I'd listened to where the host would be, you know, she'd often take the declarations of love and analyze them. And she's like, it just drives me crazy because they're so nonspecific. Like, you make me feel so wonderful. You're so beautiful. Like, blah, 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 blah. I can see a future for us. And what would make her take notice was, like, when someone was actually specific. She's like, I can believe this person has either fallen in love or at least has been made to believe that they have fallen in love, because they will say things like, you know, I notice how well you listen to everybody. I notice, like, you know, specific things about them. So anyway, this is...
It's like this one princess model.
Yes. But anyway, that long aside to say that I think you're right in that when Peter is speaking to Harriet and when he's talking to other women that he doesn't have a romantic interest in, but who he does sincerely admire, right? And he wants to pay a genuine compliment. He is always specific in a way that he isn't in the mock seduction. So the scene with Miss Meatyard where he says, if I were a painter, I'd like to paint you. You have interesting bones. Mm-hmm. It reminds me, speaking of Anne Dorland, this is where she came up in our pre-chat. It reminded me a lot of when he took her out for the dinner at the end of Unpleasantness at the Bologna Club. He orders like a nice red, like a full-bodied red wine. Mm-hmm. And basically, I forget the exact compliment he pays her, but he's sort of saying, like, you know, one day you'll find a man, like, if you find a man who can appreciate this kind of wine, you'll find a man who appreciates you. And it's interesting, right? Because in both cases, there's still, he's paying a very direct compliment. In a way, it's like a little bit, you know, both of these are about a woman's like either appearance or her personality of like, oh, this draws people in, like, you are attractive in this way. But in both cases, he also distances himself, right? It's not like, oh, I find you, a man of discerning taste will one day appreciate you, Anne Dorland.
Yeah.
And then, like, were I a painter, you know, I would want to paint you, Miss Meatyard. And it's, I don't know, it's an interesting, like, I think in both cases, it really puts Peter in this position of being like the man of taste, but also it's like a really nice way of paying a compliment without it at all implying that he's romantically interested in these women, because he's like, were I not myself, you know, or like, this is the appeal you have to, like, people with taste in general, maybe is more of the implication.
And then contrasted to him when he first meets Harriet being like, I thought you'd be an attractive person to marry.
Yeah. Thought it'd be jolly to marry you.
It just seemed like a good idea.
Oh my gosh, Peter.
It's like, you know, he's at his most suave when he's the least interested slash maybe repelled.
Yeah.
And then still like medium suave, but like impersonalized when he's just paying a lady a compliment. And then just the absolute clown when he's actually in love.
But then, you know, like circling all the way back to and have his carcass, the big fight that he and Harriet have when they both say, like, honesty is all I want.
Yeah.
And I don't want to jump ahead to Gaudy Night, but there's a moment where that also, you know, like it comes up again. You know, he says to Harriet, like, just like stick to speaking the truth. He says, that's what I love you for. Didn't you know? You know, there's a lot of stuff about, even in subtle ways, there's a lot of stuff about relationships between the sexes, right? And about equality in relationships in general, either romantic or not romantic, or, you know, like between opposite sexes or not.
Or office mates. Yeah. I mean, this book is still all about human relationship, even without Harriet being in it at all, other than a glancing aside.
I started to be like, you know, like relationships between the sexes, but that's not true. You know, like Sayers really kind of covers the ground, hearkening back to unnatural death, where there's like the examples of equality between intimate friends who might or may not be, you know, more than friends. The value on like equality and honesty in any kind of partnership is just...
I sense a theme.
It's just like, Sayers, you thought about this a lot.
Yes.
It's such a like strong, enduring, you know, like, yes, a theme and something that comes through in her characters. And I really value that as something in the books, because on the one hand, if you'd be like, oh, yes, a theme of, you know, this book is that people need to be honest with each other and with themselves. It's just like, OK, whatever. but also I'm like, sometimes I feel like that's lacking in some other things that I read, that it's taken for granted or not thought about at all. I don't know.
I think she's so attentive. These books are so attentive. And this book is so attentive to the ways, kind of the larger forces that get in the way of that honesty or that equality between people, right? The ways that, whether it's by dint of, you know, half of this copywriting staff is Oxbridge educated and public school educated, which as an American took me a long time to realize that's like the opposite thing in England, where it's like private schools. You know, half of the staff is educated that way, the other half is not. Mm-hmm. And the conversations that happen there, the ways people, some of the copywriters who don't have that education have a chip on their shoulder about it, or they assume they're being condescended to, or they are being condescended to. Like, I think there's an honesty to Sayers' writing in that regard. Like, as much as in the past we've critiqued her on like, oh, she kind of tries to get into the class stuff or the race stuff and she falls down. Mm-hmm. But I do think in this book, obviously in Gaudy Night, she is applying with more and more rigor a lens on that and like putting pressure on, you know, what is it in society that makes people misunderstand each other or just like be unable to have equal footing. Mm-hmm. Now, is that classist to assume that there could be not equality between someone who went to Eton and someone who went to a school that Peter does not consider to be a public school? Like, maybe, but I do think something I really like about this book is she's willing to go there, and she's willing to, I think we see some of the ways Peter falls short, where mm-hmm. he has class bias, or he has, you know, Miss Meatyard's like, yeah, you two, Ingleby and Breeden, you don't have to think about it at all mm-hmm. because you're, you know, you're at the top, right? You don't, like, you never have to think about class resentment. And I think even Sayers, like, I think she's pretty even-handed here and, like, clear-eyed about the ways that, like, even her hero is limited, you know, by his class standing, by his social standing, by dint of being a man or so forth. Like, yeah, I think this is a book, and maybe, you know, we'll definitely keep an eye on this as we move into the later books. But I think more and more, even her own work is, I think she's trying to be more and more honest about how human relationships in general work. And she's sort of taking up the snow globe and shaking it in different ways, right? Of like, how does this happen in an office? How does this happen in a family? How does this happen in a marriage and so forth? And we've paid a lot of attention to the marital stuff, but oh, I guess we figured out why this book is so fascinating to you and me personally.
do you think it's just that Ceres is a good writer? I think,
what?
does it boil down to that? I think,
but no, okay, yes. In this essay, I will. Look, we've been doing this podcast for so many years, and surprise, our secret thesis, Sayers is a good writer. But okay, it is that, but it's also that she's an honest writer, because I think there are so many books, both of this time and certainly now, where like, I think authors really back away from writing characters. Like, they don't want to give their characters the wrong attitudes or the, like, I guess fully fleshing out characters. I'm going to meander a little bit. But,
okay.
Like, I think a lot about how a lot of historical romances that are written now only work because you have to, like, kind of import modern ideas into the hero and the heroine because they're set in time periods where, like, you know, if you were a woman and you got married, you had no legal identity.
Yeah.
That's like you stopped being a person in the eyes of the law. And that is a big problem. And there's the part of me where I'm like, oh, I read these for escapism. And I don't care that there weren't, you know, a gajillion dukes in Regency England. Like, I will read this whole series all about a set of dukes, you know. But I think they're not interested in verisimilitude, right, at all. And I think there's often a, like, you know, a rah-rah, like, she's a feminist because she thinks she doesn't need men until this duke sweeps her off her feet or so forth. And, like, honestly, some of the best historical romances I've read in the past few years are by Evie Dunmore, who wrote the League of Extraordinary Gentlewomen series set in Oxford in, like, the 1880s about suffragists who were really engaged in this like problem of, yeah, without the right to vote, without the repeal of the like Marriage Property Act, if I fall in love and get married, I stop being a person. Like, I don't know how you can have equality there. And there, you know, I just love like a really meticulously researched book in any regard where the research doesn't get in the way, you know. It's just like, oh yes, like she is really engaging with like the questions of the time and still somehow managing to, you know, create a happily ever after in this whole series. But anyway, all of that is to say that I think Sayers is a good writer. Sayers is an honest writer. And Sayers is unafraid of showing her protagonists. Not even like, it's not an unflattering light. It's just a real light, you know, of like, here's Peter, here's Harriet, warts and all. And this is, they're so fully fledged, right? I think even in this book where Peter is in disguise, like her project of taking him away and making a real person out of him is really shining through because people are products of like their times and their circumstances and their social standing and their family dynamics. And I just feel like there's never a moment where, you know, Peter acts in a way that's like against who she has established him to be as a person, just because she's unwilling to depict him negatively or because she needs her audience to like him too much. Like she can show him being brutal. She can show him being thoughtless. Mm-hmm. She can show him being classist because of all that character work that she's already put in. She has to be honest to it.
I feel like that circling all the way back to the beginning in Whose Body, right? Because from the beginning, we were able to see him being kind of the ultimate vulnerability.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, Sayers is a really good writer.
Glad we established that.
Yeah. I'm glad we figured that out. To take it back to like the mechanics of the mystery and the politics of the Pym's publicity staff. We talked before about the conflict between Mr. Copley and Mr. Tallboy, and then the great Nutrax row. And so this is kind of like an offshoot of that that combines with it to lead to like the events that lead to the climax of the book, which, you know, we're going to be covering in more detail next time when we kind of sum up. But this like smaller conflict kind of starts that snowball rolling that's going to turn into an avalanche.
Yeah. It's really, yeah, it's just a few pages in chapter 10. But I think it's the most explicit that the book gets up to this point about these issues of class resentment and really spelling out, right, that at Pym's, like Ingleby and Breeden, that there is this divide based off of education. So, and that the copywriters with the quote unquote lesser education think about this a lot more. So Mr. Smale says, "Ah, you must be paying super tax, old man," gives him a prod in the ribs with his umbrella. "Don't do that," said Mr. Tallboy. "Tallboy needn't worry," said Mr. Smale with a rallying air. "He's got more money than he knows what to do with. We all know that, don't we, Miss Meatyard?" "He's luckier than most, then," said Miss Meatyard. "He can afford to chuck his quids over the office 50 at a time," pursued Mr. Smale. "Wish I knew where he gets it from. Dare say the income tax authorities would like to know, too. I'll tell you what, Miss Meatyard, this man's a dark horse. I believe he runs a dope den or a bucket shop on the sly, eh?" "You're one, you are," said Mr. Smale, extending a roguish forefinger and jabbing it into Mr. Tallboy's second waistcoat button. At this moment, the lift descended and Miss Meatyard stepped into it. Mr. Tallboy, rudely thrusting Mr. Smale aside, stepped in after her. "Here," said Mr. Smale. "Manners, manners. The trouble with you, old man," he went on, "is that you can't take a joke. No offense meant, I'm sure, and none taken, I hope." He clapped Mr. Tallboy on the shoulder. "Do you mind keeping your hands off me, Smale?" said Mr. Tallboy. "Oh, all right, your hands." So, like, Smale is really, he's, like, we've all been in that situation where we're like, the joke's over. Like, let it go. He doesn't know when to let the joke go. But later on, he says to, so Meatyard, Breeden, Ingleby, they're all in Meatyard's office. And he says, Smale says, "I suppose Tallboy thinks I'm not worth speaking to just because he's been to a public school and I haven't." "Public school," said Mr. Breeden. "First I've heard of it. What public school?" "He's at Dumbleton," said Mr. Smale. "But what I say is I went to a council school and I'm not ashamed of it." "Where's Dumbleton?" demanded Ingleby. "I shouldn't worry, Smale. Dumbleton isn't a public school within the meaning of the act." "Isn't it?" said Mr. Smale hopefully. "Well, you and Mr. Breeden have college education, so you know all about it. What schools do you call public schools?" "Eton," said Mr. Breeden promptly. "And Harrow," he added magnanimously, for he was an Eton man. "Rugby," suggested Mr. Ingleby. "No, no," protested Breeden. "That's a railway junction." Ingleby delivered a brisk left-hander to Breeden's jaw, which the latter parried neatly. "And I've heard," Breeden went on, "that there's a decentish sort of place at Winchester, if you're not too particular." "I once met a man who'd been to Marlborough," suggested Ingleby. "I'm sorry to hear that," said Breeden. "They get a terrible set of hardy roughs down there. You can't be too careful of your associates, Ingleby." "Well," said Mr. Smale, "Tallboy always says that Dumbleton is public school." "I dare say it is, in the sense that it has a board of governors," said Ingleby, "but it's nothing to be snobbish about." And then Breeden says, "What is it if you come to that? Look here, Smale, if only you people could get it out of your heads that these things matter a damn, you'd be a darn sight happier. You probably got a 50 times better education than I ever did." Mr. Smale shook his head. "Oh, no," he said, "I'm not deceiving myself about that, and I'd give anything to have had the same opportunities as you. There's a difference, and I know there's a difference, and I don't mind admitting it. But what I mean is, some people make you feel it, and others don't. I don't feel it when I'm talking to either you, or to Mr. Armstrong or Mr. Hankin, although you've been to Oxford and Cambridge and all that. Perhaps it's just because you've been to Oxford and Cambridge." He struggled with the problem, embarrassing the other two men with his wistful eyes. "Look here," said Miss Meatyard, "I know what you mean, but it's just that these two here never think twice about it. They don't have to. You don't have to either. But the minute anybody begins to worry about whether he's as good as the next man, then he starts a sort of uneasy, snobbish feeling and makes himself offensive." So I realize I just read like 3 pages of this book to you. But it's so interesting. It's just like they come out and like, Peter is being terribly snobbish here. Like, this is a public school. This is not a public school. But Smale is still like, you know, despite all that, like, I don't feel like you're lording it over me. It's just fascinating. I think it like, we'll put a pin in this as we head in towards the end of the book and also eventually when we get to Gaudy Night. But I just, it's like a scene that I think both doesn't let Peter off the hook. Mm-hmm. But then it is interesting that it ends up with Smale being like, "Oh, but you've never made me feel small," yeah, even though I just listened to you both banter about, you know, how all these schools that I didn't even have a hope of getting into, like, aren't really posh schools.
Yeah. We've kind of circled over the same ground a couple of times talking about, like, the class difference and does it matter? And, like, obviously it does make a real difference. Kind of like what Miss Meatyard is saying, that like, we all know that it makes a difference, and they just think that it doesn't matter because they don't have to think about it.
It doesn't matter to them,
but then it's like also like pointing out that if you spend your time worrying about whether having access to such and such makes you personally better, you know? So I think maybe kind of like the difference that's not spelled out exactly is the difference of, does having this privilege, or, you know, like, does having this access mean that you are intrinsically better, or does it just mean that you've had better opportunities? And because it does seem that Smail is being like, I know that Mr. Armstrong is better than me, and I don't mind admitting it. But it's kind of getting into like the nuts and bolts of word choice, you know, but it's like, so-and-so is not intrinsically a better person than you. They have just had more opportunities than you.
Well, and that's the difference that he says he doesn't mind admitting. It's not about better. It's opportunity, not opportunity. And I do like that Mr. Smail stands up for himself there, because I feel like Peter's whole like, oh, you know, I'm sure you had 50 times better education. Like, that's just not true.
Yeah, it's like, I it's not, and I know it's not, and I accept that it's not. But then you also seems like you get the impression that Mr. Smail, even though he is like a happy person, a gregarious person, that he also does feel like there's something lacking in himself. He accepts it, but he's also a little sad about it.
Yeah, I mean, it says he has wistful eyes, right, when thinking about this problem. And I do wish, I mean, again, this is the Sayers being brutally honest, I guess, but like, you know, embarrassing the other two men by his wistful eyes. It's interesting that the narrative itself is still, you know, we might start in Mr. Smail's point of view of getting onto the elevator with Tallboy, but the narrative ends in Breeden and Ingleby's point of view, right? Where they feel embarrassed by how their colleague acknowledges the difference between their opportunities and his wish that he could have had those opportunities. When in this situation, it's like, you know, like Smail shouldn't have to cater to their feelings. And I don't think he is, but I think, you know, when Meet Yard kind of comes in and interrupts, you know, she kind of aligns herself with Smail, even though she herself is also Oxford educated. She says, I know what you mean, Mr. Smail. It's these two here never think twice about it. I think there's also maybe a pointing out the difference because she's a woman who went to Oxford, right? So she's still kind of one step down. There's, I mean, we could probably spend an entire episode on these few pages just like unpacking. I think maybe this is just one of those places where I feel like Sayers gets really close to saying the thing. And I think she is really honest about certain aspects of it. But then at the very end, the narrative is still on the side of like, oh, you know, kind of déclassé of Mr. Smail to make everybody feel so embarrassed by like saying the thing out loud. And then the narrative point of view stays in the room after Smail leaves. And Ingleby says, I do wish they wouldn't start that sort of thing. I don't know what to say to them. Though I love that Breeden is like, I thought you were a socialist. Shouldn't bother you.
I was just flipping back to that because they've just been saying like, it's fine, it doesn't matter. And then using that like othering language, right? Like that we've all been trying to train ourselves not to do. That leads into like where we came in at the back of this whole conversation with the narrative follows Miss Meatyard when she goes out to the typist room to look at her face and be like, good bones indeed. I love when the narrative, or like the point of view, the narrative shifts so flawlessly, because it's something that you see critiqued, you know, when people call it head hopping. And it's like, yeah, when it's done badly, it sucks. Anything sucks when it's done badly. But if you do it well, it's so good. There's a part in one of the Queen's Thief books where like the narrative enters the room with one character and then the narrative leaves with a different character. And I had never even thought about it until I saw someone point it out. I was like, oh, you're right. The narrative does very organically move, and like the action moves with different characters. And like Sayers also does that where like we flawlessly move from being in Mr. Smail's perspective to Peter and Ingleby and then to Miss Meteyard. And it's so smooth. so smooth.
Chef's kiss, no notes. Yeah. No, you're right. It's one of those things that drives me absolutely nuts when it's done poorly. But when it's done well, to the point where you barely notice, it's like, oh yeah.
If you can do it well, you can do anything. As long as you're doing it well, I don't care.
Well, let me thank our new Patreon patrons real fast. So these fine folks have joined us at the $5 Harriet Vane tier per month or above since the last time we recorded. And as of this recording, which is taking place on March 10th. So thank you to Aaron, Jocelyn S., Ann W., Eli, and Tentacle Duck, which is an awesome username. So welcome to you all, and thank you so much for making this podcast possible.
Yes, we appreciate it so much. We're just so thrilled that people like the podcast enough to support it.
Truly.
It's funny because it's just the two of us, and like obviously we enjoy our conversations so much, but the work that goes into making it something that, you know, can be put out as a podcast, it's really validating to know that other people enjoy the end product so much.
Yeah. Well, and it's been so nice to have a space to, you know, now that like social media as such has really fallen apart. But yeah, just to have a space where we can talk to other people who love these books and hear from them and hear what they're, you know, enjoying and what our conversations make them think of and so forth. So that's been wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you to our listeners and our patrons. If you are interested in joining our Patreon and you haven't yet, you can find us at patreon.com/asmywhimsytakesme. You can also find our website with our show notes at asmywhimsytakesme.com. And you can email us at talkingpiffle@gmail.com.
We are also on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as @whimsypod. Our logo is by Gabby Vicioso, and our theme music was composed and recorded by Sarah Mihalik. And if you've enjoyed this episode of As My Whimsy Takes Me, or any of our episodes, and you've not yet left us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen to podcasts, we would love for you to do so. Reviews especially help new listeners find us.
See you next time for more Talking Piffle.
How increasingly unhinged our outros are getting.
I do not have a single hinge left.